Before I start, just one thing I want to ask. Hands up if you've read anything by Victor Serge. Okay, hands up if you've read more than one thing by Victor Serge. Okay, so there's a few people. So that's good. There's a couple of other notes that I want to make before I start. The first is that there's a lot of quotes from Victor Serge in my talk, which means it's a little bit long. But I presume that given you've given up on Pilger and Trevor Nguane to be here, that you mightn't mind actually hearing a bit of what Serge wrote, since he's a writer, after all, and his writing is very beautiful. So I apologise, but hopefully it won't seem excessive. The second thing I wanted to do is just to mark my awareness of the use of gendered language by Serge. He often uses men or man, where it should be people or humanity, and I just want to mark my awareness. I haven't altered that, because that's the standard of his time. I haven't altered it to reflect the standards of today. So to start, in his 1938 essay, Marxism in Our Time, Victor Serge explains his understanding of the role of the individual in history as follows. Marxism teaches us to integrate ourselves with all our will and all our talents to bring about those historical processes that are, as the case may be, necessary, inevitable, or desirable. And it's thus that it allows us to confer on our isolated lives a high significance by tying them through a consciousness which heightens and enriches the spiritual life to that life, collective, innumerable, and permanent, of which history is the only record. And in line with this understanding, in speaking of the life and literature of Victor Serge today, I'll be speaking just as much about the events and the struggles of his time in which he was an active participant. This isn't a talk about a great man in history, the pure genius of bourgeois imagination who magically alters the trajectory of society through sheer force of will, or the tortured artist conjuring literary masterpieces from the dark recesses of their soul. But neither will it be simply an accounting of events, as if the life of Victor Serge, his personality, his ideas, and his literary output could be understood as a straightforward mirror of the broader historical context. Victor Serge isn't a great man in history in the bourgeois sense of the term, but he is one of the truly great figures in the history of the workers' movement, and his life and literature are unique, I think, in giving expression to a historical milieu and moment that's all but been buried under the muck of subsequent ages. In Serge's work, we glimpse a sense of unbounded hope, the creativity and passion of a European and Russian workers' movement at its height, a flash of brilliance so bright that it would endure in the minds of millions, even in the darkest hours of subsequent decades, holding out the prospect of a society that's adequate to the truly creative and dignified nature of human existence. And it's this that, I hope that my talk can go some way towards conveying. So to start off on the revolution in life part, which goes for a while because he had a very long, an interesting life. So Viktor Kubaltschik, who was later to become known by his pen name Victor Serge, was born in Belgium in 1890 into a Europe that was riven by the class conflict and imperialist rivalries that were already driving the continent forward towards the barbaric slaughter of the First World War. And Serge became political at a very early age. His parents were Russian emigres with close connections to the Narodnaya or the Narodnik movement in Russia. And one of his uncles had actually been executed for participating in the 1881 assassination of the Russian Tsar. And in his autobiography, Memoirs of a Revolutionary, Serge recalls that, "On the walls of our humble and makeshift lodgings, there were always the portraits of men who'd been hanged. The conversations of grown-ups dealt with trials, executions, escapes, and Siberian highways, with great ideas incessantly argued over, and with the latest books about these ideas." And so it might not be surprising then that Serge was actually taking anarchist positions from age 6 onwards. So that's, primary school, or, even kindergarten or something like that. And later, when he was 15, he and his circle of friends actually joined the Belgian Young Socialists. But his sojourn within the mainstream of the Second International Social Democracy was to be short-lived. Serge and his friends quickly grew impatient with the timid reformist approach of the Socialist Party. As he relates in the memoirs, "Socialism meant reformism, parliamentarianism, and unrelieved Talmudism." And don't ask me what that means. I think it's something to do with the Torah. Our way of correcting this doctrinal rigidity was to refuse to believe in it. We had to have an absolute, only one of liberty, a principle of life, only unselfish and ardent, a principle of action, only not to win a place in this stifling world, but to try, however desperately, to escape from it, since it was impossible to destroy it. And Serge found the theory of escape in the romantic individualism of writers such as Albert Libertad, from whom he drew the lesson that it was futile to wait for revolution, and that it was necessary, as he put it, to make your own revolution by being free men and living in comradeship. And in 1909, he was actually booted out of Belgium, and he ended up in Paris, where he learnt the printing trade, and he threw himself into the really highly active anarchist milieus that existed on the margins of the French workers' movement. And it was during this period that Serge's embrace of anarchist individualism and illegalism reached its height. And to get a sense of this, it's worth reading a passage from his article, The Bandits, in which Serge responds to the public outrage at the murder of a bank worker in a hold-up by an anarchist gang. And he writes, "This so-called respect for human life they never fail to speak of after every murder. I know it to be ignobly hypocritical, since they kill in its name by hunger, work, subjection, and prison. I'm on the other side, and I'm not afraid to admit it. I'm with the bandits. The bandits demonstrate strength. The bandits demonstrate daring. The bandits demonstrate their firm determination to live. At the same time, the others submit to the landlord, the boss, and the policeman. They vote, protest against iniquities, and die as they lived, miserably." So that gives you a sense of where his politics were at that stage. But fortunately for our tradition, Serge's enthusiasm for the life of the bandit quickly waned, as the futility of individual action in the face of the power of the capitalist state became increasingly apparent. Reflecting on this period of his life in the memoirs, Serge expressed the frustration that he felt at the rapid degeneration of the anarchist circles and their ultimate demise at the hands of police repression. And he wrote, "A positive wave of violence and despair began to grow. The outlaw anarchists shot at the police and blew out their own brains. Others, overpowered before they could fire the last bullet into their own heads, went off sneering to the guillotine. I saw the whole of the movement founded by Libertad dragged into the scum of society by a kind of madness, and nobody could do anything about it, least of all myself." And to top it all off, the French police clearly took seriously the saying that words are weapons, and in 1912, Serge was arrested and sentenced to 5 years jail for his alleged role in instigating, through his writing, the crimes of the anarchist gangs. And Serge's jail time, which included long periods in solitary confinement, later became the inspiration for his novel Men in Prison, in which the senseless violence and brutality of the prison functions as a symbol for the broader barbarities of the capitalist society as a whole. And to cope with the extreme isolation and boredom that he experienced in jail, Serge spent his time, as he put it, mentally editing a daily revolutionary newspaper, and in deep reflection on the human condition that reinforced the really deeply humanist perspective that was to characterise his writing from this point onwards. And the essence of Serge's humanism is poignantly expressed in a passage from his novel Birth of Our Power, which is based on his experiences during the years from 1917 to 1919, which is between his release from jail and his eventual arrival in revolutionary Petrograd. Describing an afternoon spent swimming in the Mediterranean Sea near the Spanish-French border, Serge first evokes the beauty and joy of human existence. "The swimmer's feeling of plenitude, the cool of the water, the soft curves of the waves as you cut through them, mirrorings, breakings, suspensions of crystal and of liquid dust which capture the rays of the light in midair in immaterial jewels. It's more beautiful than cities, more beautiful than rains, more beautiful than nights, more beautiful than dreams. It's, I forget to think, but an idea comes to the surface, the words cut out in striking relief. It would be so good to live." However, immediately following this passage, as the swimmers come in sight of a nearby beach, the mood changes really dramatically. A breach between the rocks suddenly reveals the next beach, an old house, a barrel, a bench, and on the bench, a man. Slumped down rather than seated, his back against the wall, propped up on crutches, skeletal hands. The heel of one frail leg is dug into the fine gravel. The other is cut off well above the knee. Does this man see us? Celestin Brack, fisherman by trade, twice gassed, right leg amputated, decorated by order of one army for his exploits in the Hodramont woods, where he may have dealt a fate similar to his to some fisherman from Swinemund, whom I imagine sprawling at this very hour in the same position before the Baltic and its soft, slate-grey reflections. We see him as an accusation. So here, the beauty and potential of human life is contrasted directly with the insane barbarity of war. And it's this gap between the reality of Europe and the vision of a better, more humane way of living that represented for Serge a source of moral obligation to struggle against the system. And Serge didn't waste any time in getting involved. Immediately upon his release from jail in 1917, he travelled to Barcelona, where he arrived just in time to participate in a failed syndicalist uprising. But the breakout of the Russian Revolution in February 1917 added a whole new sense of urgency. As Serge recalls, reading the dispatches from Russia, we were transfigured, for the images that they conveyed were simple, concrete. Minute clarity was shed over things. The world was no longer impelled along by helpless lunacy. So Serge attempted to find his way back to Russia through France, but unfortunately he was quickly detained, this time for being a suspected Bolshevik sympathiser. And he spent the next year in a French internment camp, passing the time in a thorough study of Marx and in really passionate discussion and debate with fellow Russian émigrés about the significance of the October Revolution and the Bolshevik Party that led it. And finally, in October 1918, the French government agreed to exchange Serge and other revolutionaries for a number of anti-Bolshevik prisoners who were being held captive in Russia. By the time they started the journey, the First World War had ended, and the eyes of European workers were really now firmly fixed on developments in the newly established Soviet regime. And Serge recounts the following episode that occurred when his group came across some British soldiers who were drinking in a tavern, and please excuse my poor dramatic skills for this one. They noticed our unusual appearance. "Who are you lot? Where are you going?" "Revolutionaries, we're going to Russia." 30 tanned faces surrounded us eagerly. There were hearty exclamations all round us, and we had to shake everybody's hand. So Serge arrived in Petrograd in January 1919, to find the city and the Soviet government in a really desperate struggle to survive. The mortal danger that the revolution was in during this time and the hardships endured by the Russian workers and peasants in its defence can't be overestimated. Supported by approximately 200,000 troops from 14 different countries, the defeated Russian ruling class formed a white army that launched an all-out attack on the Soviet regime. The whites didn't win the war, but they decimated the Russian working class, and they contributed to the further devastation of the Russian economy. Industrial production fell to one-fifth of pre-war levels. The population of Petrograd fell from 2.4 million to 574,000 as workers were lost to the front or returned to the countryside to survive. And factory closures had actually seen two-thirds of the workforce unemployed, and those who remained were living on a food ration that amounted to 10% of what was needed to sustain a manual worker. So Serge was really shocked by the harsh reality of the Soviet regime, but he was struck at the same time by the power of the revolutionary spirit that drove the Russian workers to hold on in the face of the unspeakable deprivations of the Civil War. And this will to endure was described by Serge in a short piece of prose he wrote in the early 1920s, entitled Flame on the Snow. The will to undergo everything, to suffer everything, achieve everything in order to finish. inexorable will. The will to live finally according to the new law, equal work, or to die showing the way. The willingness to plough up the ground in its souls so well that the earth shall be new tomorrow. Consciousness that a world collapses and that you can live only while giving yourself to the world which waits to be born. So Serge actually really threw himself into the war effort, and on two occasions he actually took up arms in defence of Petrograd when it seemed inevitable that they were going to be overrun by the whites. And Serge's experience at this time was later to become the inspiration for the novel Conquered City, which provides a vivid account of the atmosphere in Petrograd in 1919, and his most well-known historical work, Year One of the Russian Revolution, really provides the historical context for that. And not long after he arrived in Petrograd, Serge joined the Bolsheviks. This was quite a difficult decision for him to make, given his anarchist background and the many connections that he retained with strongly anti-Bolshevik intellectuals and writers. In the memoirs, he describes his thinking at the time as follows. I moved among intellectuals who wept for their dream of an enlightened democracy, governed by a sagacious parliament, and inspired by an idealistic press, their own, of course. Every conversation I had with them convinced me that, face to face with the ruthlessness of history, they were wrong. I saw that their cause of democracy had, at the end of the summer of 1917, stood between two fires. And it seemed obvious to me that, if the Bolshevik insurrection had not taken power at that point, the cabal of old generals, supported by the officers' organizations, would certainly have done so instead. Russia would have avoided the Red Terror only to endure the White, and a proletarian dictatorship only to undergo a reactionary one. In consequence, the most outraged observations of the anti-Bolshevik intellectuals only revealed to me how necessary Bolshevism was. So Serge's adherence to Bolshevism reflects a real shift that occurred in his thinking during the 5 years he spent in jail, and in particular following the outbreak of the Russian Revolution in 1917. By the time Serge returned to Russia, he'd made a conscious break with anarchism, partly based on his own experience of its failures in France and elsewhere, but much more, I think, on the thorough study of Marxism that he undertook while he was interned. From 1919 through the end of his life, Serge was a Marxist, and he held fast to its core principles that saw revolution as a necessarily democratic and collective action of the working class itself. His view of the Russian Revolution and its aftermath is very much in line with this. He recognized the new regime, harsh as it was in the context of the Civil War, as the product of a genuine workers' revolution. Soviet power was, for Serge, the power of the organized working class. So Serge's decision to join the Bolsheviks wasn't, as some have argued, consistent with the anarchist elitism of his youth, which saw revolution as a matter for a morally superior clique of activists standing above a passive and conformist mass. The party, as he saw it, was essential to the extent that it brought together the most conscious and advanced sections of the working class. And this was particularly the case in the first years following the revolution, during which time the Russian ruling class, with the support of the entire bourgeois world, was organising itself to drown the revolution in blood. The fact is that the Bolsheviks were the only force in Russia who both wanted to defend the gains of the revolution and knew what you had to do to actually do that. This is how Serge described the various oppositional groups that were active at the time. Except for the workers' opposition, these dissenters, who were always falling out among themselves, had become politically bankrupt in different ways. The Mensheviks were outright opponents of the seizure of power by the Bolsheviks. The seizure of power by the Soviets. The left social revolutionaries had first boycotted the Bolshevik authorities, then collaborated with them, and then, in July 1918, raised an insurrection against them, proclaiming their intention to govern alone. The anarchists were chaotically subdivided into pro-Soviet, anti-Soviet and intermediate tendencies. In 1919, the anti-Soviet anarchists had thrown a bomb into a plenary session of the Communist Party's Moscow Committee with a total of 15 victims. And the anarchist movement, with which Serge actually maintained quite friendly relations throughout, he described as a lamentable chaos of sectarian good intentions. And the extent of his break with this tradition is clearly illustrated by the comment he makes in the memoirs that anarchism was basically a doctrine of far more emotive power than intellectual. And you might not think that sounds so bad, but if you really want to change the world, then, you know, it matters. So while in doing so, he risked the disapproval of his friends, Serge threw himself into work with the Bolsheviks to defend the gains of the revolution in Russia and to seek to advance its cause abroad. As he wrote later, "My mind was made up. I was neither against the Bolsheviks nor neutral. I was with them, albeit independently, and without renouncing thought or critical sense." So what this translated to into practice was, on the one hand, untiring work for the Soviet regime, and particularly in the newly formed Third or Communist International. Like all the main Bolshevik leaders of the time, Serge could see that the survival of workers' power in Russia depended entirely on the success of revolutionary movements in more advanced Western European countries like Germany. As Serge himself relates, "It was a generally accepted thesis, which Lenin stated several times, that Russia, agricultural and backwards as it was, could not create a lasting socialist system for itself by its own efforts, and that consequently we should be overcome sooner or later unless the European revolution assured socialism of a broader and more viable base." So reflecting this, for the next 7 years, Serge worked for the Comintern, seeking to hasten the spread of revolution abroad. And he later described himself and his colleagues as emissaries, functionaries, secretaries, editors, translators, printers, organizers, directors, members of the collegium, and then some. And amongst all that, he also did some smuggling, I think, to Finland in his spare time, probably. And the more, I want to talk a bit about the more independent and sort of critical side of Serge's relation to Bolshevism. And this was reflected in his concern to foster and protect what he saw as the libertarian core of the revolution. As Serge wrote in the essay Marxism in Our Time, "Socialism is essentially democratic, the word democratic being used here in its libertarian sense. Liberty is as necessary to socialism, the spirit of liberty is as necessary to Marxism as oxygen is to living beings." Now, Serge saw the October Revolution as the ultimate expression of this spirit of liberty, which is manifested in the immense energy and creativity of the workers and in the intense political and intellectual struggles that characterize the movement. But he could also see that the gains made by the working class towards a society in which, as Marx famously said, you know, the free development of each is a condition for the free development of all, he could see that this was coming under threat from the isolated and desperate situation that the Soviets were in by 1919. The various repressive measures that the Soviet government imposed during the Civil War were, as Serge saw them, a necessary evil in the context of a desperate struggle to survive. But he was concerned to battle against what he saw as excesses resulting largely from the zeal of many lower-level communist officials who joined the party in the aftermath of the revolution and who were increasingly more concerned with building careers than building socialism. And as time went on, and the isolation of the Soviet regime increased, the contradiction between the libertarian core of socialism and the desperate reality of conditions in Russia began to grow. And it was in these conditions that the first distinct signs of the later Stalinist counter-revolution began to appear. Serge's deep commitment to individual liberty as essential to the emergence of a truly socialist society made him particularly sensitive to these developments. Nevertheless, he was determined to keep on fighting. As he later explained, "I didn't feel disheartened or disoriented. My conclusions were that the Russian Revolution, left to itself, would probably, in one way or another, collapse. That the Russians, who'd made superhuman efforts to build a new society, were more or less at the end of their strength. And that relief and salvation must come from the West. I decided to leave for Central Europe, which seemed to be the focus of events to come." So in 1922, under his role with the Comintern, Serge travelled to Germany, where the following year he witnessed the tragic defeat of the German Revolution, and he really clearly realised the immense significance of this for the hopes of workers in Russia. He wrote, If only. From 1923 until his return to Russia in 1926, he continued his work in Germany and later Austria, you know, really putting all his energy into the fading prospect of revolution in the West. So on his return to Russia, Serge unfortunately found that the situation there had taken a dramatic turn for the worse. Following Lenin's death in 1924, Stalin pronounced the doctrine of socialism in one country, which went against the basic tenets of Marxism to which all the main leaders of the revolution had adhered. And Serge recognised this as a decisive break with the traditions of October, and he could see now that Russia was well on the way towards a restoration of a form of class society. He threw himself into the left opposition, which was led by Leon Trotsky, and began organising the small number of other revolutionaries who were prepared to take a stand. And he recalls, "Using assumed names, I spoke in outlying districts. One of my groups, consisting of half a dozen working men and women, held its meetings in the shade of low fir trees in an abandoned cemetery. I'd stand on the graves and discuss the confidential reports of the Central Committee, the news from China, and Mao Zedong's articles." But this was, unfortunately, to be a futile battle. A small number of oppositionists were completely overwhelmed by, you know, the mass kind of rank and file of the Communist Party members who joined well after the revolution, actually, most of them in the so-called Lenin enrolment of 1924. And this mass of petty officials and bureaucrats had no interest in the opposition's message of continued struggle for socialism on an international scale. Having won a privileged place for themselves within the new regime, they were only too happy to fall in behind the Stalinist push for stability based on the consolidation of current arrangements in Russia and at the expense of revolution abroad. So Serge and his fellow oppositionists ended up being expelled from the party in October 1927, which is a bit ironic, 10 years following the October Revolution. For the next 5 years, a bit surprisingly, from 1928 to 1933, Serge was actually allowed to live at liberty in Petrograd. And this actually proved to be the most prolific period for his writing. During this time, he wrote many of his most well-known works, including Year One of the Russian Revolution, Men in Prison, Birth of Our Power, and Conquered City. However, he was subject to constant harassment and surveillance by the Stalinist secret police, the GPU, which actually ended up driving his first wife mad because he became so paranoid about this. And Serge himself was arrested in 1933 and accused of taking part in a conspiracy against the state. Now, in the context of the increasing paranoia of the Stalinist regime, this was a very dangerous situation to be in. And it was one in which Serge's prominence as a writer, particularly in France, was kind of a blessing and a curse. His existence threatened the Stalinists with exposure in the international press. But at the same time, in contrast to the countless other oppositionists who were arrested, Serge couldn't simply be made to disappear without a fuss. He was subject to a psychologically brutal interrogation, which I think from memory lasted like 67 days or something like that, in which the GPU tried every trick in the book to build a case against him that could be made to look legitimate in the eyes of the French press. But despite being confronted with the supposed confession of an administrative assistant who'd done some translation work for him, who said, you know, Serge is organising to, you know, with the fascists, etc., all that kind of stuff, Serge refused to succumb to the pressure. His experience of interrogation later provided material for the novel The Case of Comrade Tuleyev, which is a really harrowing account of Stalin's machinery of repression in the years immediately before the infamous Moscow trials. And it really allows you to understand how those trials actually worked and, you know, how they got confessions out of people. But luckily for Serge, in the absence of an admission on his part of guilt, it was impossible for the GPU to gain the pretext they needed for an execution. And instead, he was subject to exile in the city of Orenburg, which is in what's now Kazakhstan. So Serge spent 3 years in Orenburg from 1933 to 1936, before an increasingly vocal campaign by French activists and writers finally led to him being granted permission to leave Russia. During this exile, Serge and his son Vladi actually came to the brink of starvation, along with a lot of other people in Russia at the time, and really suffered in the unbearable heat and cold of the Russian steppe. But there was also actually a limited political life within a small circle of fellow oppositionists and outcasts of various kinds, whose spirit and fortitude in the face of these unimaginable horrors was later to be recounted by Serge in his novel Midnight of the Century. And there was also actually ample time for writing. Tragically, however, the works that Serge completed in Russia, which included Year Two of the Russian Revolution and a novel that he regarded as having best conveyed the grandeur of the revolution, were confiscated by the Russian police as he left the country, and they've actually never been seen again, despite extensive search following 1989. So Serge left Russia for Belgium and later France in 1936. However, his newfound freedom had its own set of difficulties. As one of a rapidly dwindling number of Russian oppositionists, he was, like Trotsky, subject to hostility from both the right and the so-called left. To the bourgeoisie, he remained a dangerous revolutionary, and also, initially, in the context of the French Popular Front, an irritant to their alliance with the communists. And to the communists, he was a Trotskyist fascist, a traitor to the cause who deserved only threats and insults and, the threat of death, basically, hung over him. And following Serge's arrival in Paris in 1936, he joined with the city's tiny Trotskyist organisation to set up a committee for inquiry into the Moscow trials, which, kind of on similar lines to the Dewey inquiry in the US. As he relates in the memoirs, "We had no money at all, and the Popular Front's press was closed to us. For years there'd be this struggle of no more than a handful of individual consciences against the total suppression of the truth, in the face of crimes which were beheading the Soviet Union and would soon bring about the downfall of the Spanish Republic. Often we felt like voices crying in the wilderness." So it was really in almost complete isolation then that in 1940, Serge and his family fled across France during a Nazi invasion that was all but being welcomed by large sections of the French bourgeoisie. Ending up in Marseille, Serge waged another desperate struggle to gain the visas necessary to escape from Europe. And he later commented on this process that people with money and no political commitments got visas, generally speaking, rather easily. A host of anti-fascist fighters did not get them at all. So, a lot of commonalities between what happened then and what happens today with refugees. Finally, Serge actually gained his passage to Mexico, where he stayed until his death in 1947, he wrote his memoirs during that period. But he ended up dying just as he lived, poverty-stricken and without even a decent pair of shoes to his name. So that's the revolution in life part of the title of this talk. But before I finish, I just want to say a bit about revolution in literature. So talk of literature is to some extent uncomfortable terrain for Marxists, and some people might not agree, because I know there are some literary theorists in the room, Marxist literary theorists. Rejecting the idealism of bourgeois aesthetics, we recognise that what happens in art can only be a more or less mediated reflection of the more properly historical realm of the productive life of society and the world-shaping struggles that occur there. But while we're right to reject the view that art can somehow evoke a kind of beauty and truth that stands above the complex and mucky reality of history, this doesn't mean that we have to deny that good art can really express something essential about our lives, something that can help guide us towards a deeper understanding of ourselves and of the society in which we're part of. Anyone who's ever fallen in love with a particular band, a piece of music, a painting, or a novel will understand the sentiment expressed by the poet William Carlos Williams, that it's difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there. Which is all really a bit of a roundabout way of saying that art is important, and that its significance should not be seen purely in terms of how useful it is for the immediate struggles of the day. And Victor Serge's understanding of the role his literary works could play in relation to the broader revolutionary movement was in line with this Marxist approach. Up until 1928, when he was expelled from the Communist Party, he didn't really devote much energy at all to his writing, just occasionally wrote short prose pieces, a bit of poetry, that kind of thing. As he put it in their memoirs, "I'd renounced writing when I entered the Russian Revolution. Literature seemed quite a secondary matter, so far as I was personally concerned, in an age like this. My duty was dictated by history itself." So arriving in Petrograd in the immediate aftermath of the revolution, Serge recognised that the primary task was the practical one of defending workers' power. However, when in 1928 Serge was actually expelled from the Communist Party, and it became apparent that both Russian and European society was entering into a potentially lengthy period of reaction, his vocation as a writer gained a new lease of life. What disturbed him most was the idea that the legacy of 1917 could be completely buried, wiped from the pages of history by the unrelenting distortions and the filth poured upon it by Stalinism. In light of this, Serge set himself the task of expressing the reality of revolution to preserve it for the benefit of future generations. And this work had two aspects. You know, one aspect of it was the work of history, you know, the painstaking recreation of events based on the most thorough research and documentation. So then you have books like Year One of the Russian Revolution and From Lenin to Stalin and his other historical works. But history of this kind could not, as Serge saw it, succeed in expressing in full the reality of the revolutionary movement. Historical work, Serge wrote, does not allow enough scope for showing men as they really live, dismantling their inner workings and penetrating deep inside their souls. For this, literary creation is required, as a means, Serge says, of communion, a testimony to the vast flow of life through us, whose essential aspects we must try to fix for the benefit of those who will come after us. Now, I know that the idea of dismantling inner workings and penetrating deep inside our souls sounds a little on the idealistic side, and you know, there's no doubt that Serge actually did stray into that at times. His son, Vladdy, who's actually a famous artist in Mexico, describes Serge as a spiritual materialist. But the spiritual side of Serge's humanism is offset, for the most part, by his understanding of the life of the individual as inherently bound up with the collective life of society. And this is reflected even in the style that he writes in. Serge consciously sought to avoid the form of the classical novel, which centres, as he puts it, upon a few beings artificially detached from the world. His novels are characterised by a highly disjunctive narrative that jumps from one scenario to the next without regard for the continuity of experience or the development of a clear protagonist. And the effect is to make the characters in Serge's novels seem quite insignificant in comparison to the broader social processes that are swirling around them. And to the extent I think that there is a protagonist in Serge's novels, it's actually history itself, or more specifically, the history of the European and Russian workers' movement as it navigates the epic triumphs and tragedies of the early 20th century. And this really isn't a topic that's very well fitted to the kind of smooth unfolding and development that's characteristic of, you know, the classical novel. However, while Serge wasn't, as some have claimed, simply concerned with a you know, straightforward kind of recounting of his own experiences, it would be a mistake to place too much emphasis on the particularities of his style. For while there was an element of conscious decision about this, there was also a strong influence from the circumstance in which he wrote. Serge recalls in relation to his life in Petrograd between 1928 and 1933, "I asked myself every day whether I'd not be arrested in the night. For my books, I adopted an appropriate form. I had to construct them in detached fragments, which could each be separately completed and sent abroad post-haste, which could, if absolutely necessary, be published as they were, incomplete, and it would have been difficult for me to compose in any other form." The second characteristic of Serge's novels that I want to comment on is the level of optimism and hope that they express. And this is surprising, I think, given when you look at the circumstances in which a lot of his books were written. Based on a life story like his, you might expect that in his later works, at least, the tone of optimistic humanism in novels such as Birth of Our Power would have succumbed to the harsh realities that he'd suffered through. And there's no doubt that the novels that he wrote during his exile, really, the subject matter was quite bleak. Works such as Midnight of the Century and the case of Comrade Tuliev don't hold back in their depiction of the inhuman cruelty of the Stalinist bureaucracy. But what's striking about these works is that despite the depictions of suffering that they entail, the focus really remains on the innate human capacity for resistance. So just for one example, the final chapter of Midnight of the Century, which is titled The Beginning, ends with a vision of renewal. Of, the search writes, the Russian earth, the tortured earth of the revolution, its countless living prisoners, its countless executed ones in graves, its construction sites, its masses, its solitudes, and all the seeds germinating in its womb. And I think that the continuing hopefulness of Serge's literary output can be explained with reference to the historical works in which he attempts to come to grips with the transition from Soviet democracy to Stalinist totalitarianism. Having been witness to the reality of Soviet power in the immediate aftermath of the revolution, he could clearly see the disjuncture between the Bolshevik Party that stood at the head of the victorious Russian working class in October 1917 and the party that expelled him and his oppositionist comrades in October 1927. And in works such as From Lenin to Stalin and Russia 20 Years After, Serge assembles a formidable volume of evidence for the fact that the ultimate defeat of the revolution and the rise of the Stalinist bureaucracy had much more to do with its failure to spread abroad than with this or that policy of the Bolsheviks. Serge asks, what greater injustice can be imagined towards the Russian Revolution than to judge it in the light of Stalinism alone? Of Stalinism which emerged from it, it's true, only to kill it. But in the course of 13 or 15 years of struggles, by favour of the defeat of socialism in Europe and Asia. And Serge's faith that he maintained in the capacity for humanity to resist, even in the 20th century's darkest moments, derives, I'd argue, from his long experience as a participant in the workers' movement, when it's combined also with the ideas that he developed from his study of Marxism. And late in his life, Serge wrote of Marxism that it's so firmly based in truth that it's able to find nourishment even in its own defeats. And this is a view, I think, that really comes through quite strongly in the novels he wrote during this period. So, to conclude, the world of today is one in which the brutal reality of the capitalist system, with its grotesque inequalities, its environmental destruction, war and oppression, can seem more powerful than ever. In this context, the work of Victor Serge has a unique capacity to inspire. It furnishes us with the moral strength, the courage and creativity needed to stand against the system. And it does this by evoking the lived experience of revolution, an experience that ingrained a vision of a much better future in the minds of millions of workers of Serge's generation. It was this vision that drove Victor Serge and that forged in him an indestructible belief in the potential of the working class to resist, even in the most desperate of circumstances. And it's in this vision, illustrated by his life and powerfully expressed in his literature, that the legacy of Victor Serge for today is to be found. The last words of my talk I'm going to leave for Victor Serge himself, who, to the extent that there's a take-home message for today, can express it a lot more eloquently than I could ever hope to. Reflecting on his experience in the memoirs, Serge wrote, "Early on, I learnt from the Russian intelligentsia that the only meaning of life lies in the conscious participation in the making of history. The more I think of that, the more deeply true it seems to be. It follows that one must range oneself actively against everything that diminishes man and involve oneself in all struggles which tend to liberate and enlarge him. This categorical imperative is in no way lessened by the fact that such an involvement is inevitably soiled by error. It's a worse error to live for oneself, caught within traditions which are soiled by inhumanity." That's it.